From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, representatives for the International Joint Commission kick off their Great Lakes tour in Milwaukee. Then, although women are often the target of HPV vaccination marketing, an advocate says there needs to be a greater focus on men.
I have made it my mission to try and educate men on getting out there and getting vaccinated because it's a subset of our population that still could be harboring the virus and spreading it.
Beats Me looks at the lack of black male physicians and how that affects patient outcomes. And Milwaukee Magazine's pet feature explores the appeal of the non-traditional.
If you're interested in a pet, but you don't want the time commitment of a dog or a cat, and you don't mind the idea of something with scales or six or eight legs, it's a great place to go.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for being with us today. I'm Bonnie North. The International Joint Commission, or IJC, is a U.S.-Canadian body that was created to ensure the two countries take care of the waters they share. Those waters, of course, include the Great Lakes. Recently, the six-member commission visited Milwaukee to launch its Step In and Speak Out for the Great Lakes tour. Lake Effect's Susan Bent sat down with the U.S. and Canadian chairs, Jane Corwin and Pierre Bellan, to learn more. Bellan says the IJC is unique. As a watchdog for the country's shared waters, the commission is above politics and government.
I think people in general love the IJC, which is a good thing these days. People have confidence in the IJC, and you get to meet everyone, from the public to those who operate dams, power utilities, and mayors, and the industry, and governments as well. And it's fascinating. And the binational nature is what attracts me most, maybe, Americans and Canadians working together for the benefit of water and the people that live from it.
Can you take us back in time to just a short history lesson on how the IJC started?
Well, it was founded in 1909, based on a treaty signed by Canada and the U.S. I think it originated from a sort of disagreement over who owned water between Montana and Alberta. When a river crosses the border more than once and one side decides to dam the river to obtain more water for irrigation, obviously the other side retaliates and says, I'm going to build a dam just upstream from the border. You know, nobody shot at anybody, but it went to a point where it was not possible to have these people sit together and find a solution. So both governments decided to establish the IJC. And through that treaty, they sort of abandoned part of their sovereignty over those boundary waters, because whenever someone from either country wants to do something that would change the level or the flow of the river or of a lake that straddles or is along the border, they have to apply to the IJC, and the IJC, like Solomon, decides what is best for both. And then, if the governments agree, the IJC will be responsible for managing those waters. And, I mean, that's the final decision. Of course, the IJC can review its orders, but basically, no one can really appeal the decisions. And the three U.S. commissioners are appointed by the president, and the three Canadian commissioners are appointed by the Prime Minister's Office, or Privy Council, which is basically Ministry of the Prime Minister. This year, Jane and her two colleagues and myself, we were appointed almost at the same time. So this was the first time since 1909, I guess, that the six commissioners had been appointed at the same time.
When it comes to the Great Lakes and the duties and the programs that the IJC shepherds, is the water level and the flow, are those the key categories that you're covering?
I think there are two aspects. The responsibility that the governments gave to the IJC to oversee whether or not there was progress on the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement that was signed in 1972 by Prime Minister Trudeau and was it Nixon or Nixon? Okay, so they signed this agreement to clean up the Great Lakes and they said, we will ask the IJC to oversee this on a regular basis, telling us, are we doing our job or not? But totally aside from that, previously the IJC had received references from the governments on regulating basically two dams. One which is between Lake Superior and Lake Huron, and the other which is downstream of Lake Ontario, the Moses Saunders Dam. So these are the only two works that we regulate in terms of flow and level. But you can imagine that owing to the size of those lakes and owing to the amount of water that can fall from the sky, our power to actually regulate precisely outside of a normal range is very, very limited.
Of course, everyone recognizes that we've got record-setting levels in most of the Great Lakes, for Great Lakes as well as Erie and Ontario. And as Pierre pointed out, we have a dam that operates on the St. Lawrence at the end of Lake Ontario. So there is this perception that, well, we just open the dam and all the water comes out and everything will be fine. And unfortunately, that's not how it happens. Even under the previous plan prior to 2014, when we operated under 58DD, the mission was to maintain the range of level in a 4-foot range. Well, the reality was it didn't stay within that 4-foot range because you just can't control everything that affects the lake levels, particularly precipitation, snow melt, temperatures, all those other things that factor in. So when you look around at the lakes today and you see these high water levels, you see the flooding, there's not a whole lot that can be done to help it. What we have been doing in our first month, which has kept us very busy, is visiting the flooded areas, talking to the people on the ground, trying to understand if there is anything more that can be done. But more importantly, trying to raise the level of awareness of resiliency measures, how important it is for people to recognize that flooding will occur under any plan. And it's up to everyone to take precautions and do what they can in terms of improving resiliency. And we can see in Quebec, they had just announced their new program. And in New York, Governor Cuomo is beginning a resiliency commission. So my hope is going forward that the energy and effort is focused on the right things, which is how to help ourselves as people protect our property in terms of resiliency. But as far as water levels and whether or not they can be controlled, they really can't be.
So to explain 58DD, just so people know.
Sure, that was the plan that was implemented when the dams were first installed in 1958. I think the plan went into effect in 62. It was a year or two after. Again, it was meant to try to keep the levels steady. But if you look at the historical data, you see that even under that plan, there were years of flooding and there were years of exceptionally low levels. So even in our best attempts to try to regulate that level, it really didn't happen. 2014 is intended to mimic the natural flow of the lake a little bit more, which would allow for increasing wetlands. But the plan really only affects the level by about 6 centimeters, or the width of a tennis ball. So it's not a huge difference. And what's happening now and what's happened in 2017 is we've just had such an excessive amount of rainfall and snowpack and quick melting of the snow that no plan, either one of them in place, would not have made a difference in terms of controlling the levels.
Is there any one voice that you heard, a story, a perception, or something that you've seen in Milwaukee that particularly sticks with you?
We had a commentator from Milwaukee Water Commons, I believe it was, who talked about public engagement, getting the public to become water savvy, get involved and find out about drinking water and treatment of storm water and things you can do at home to minimize the runoff into lakes with contaminants and so on. And I thought, how wonderful at this stage of our lives that people, not scientists, not big government, not big money people, just regular people are saying, hey, you know what, I need to pay attention to this. This affects me and I can make a difference. And I think that's the difference now, is the general public is starting to understand we can impact water quality, and they're willing to do it, which is great.
The object of the meeting was water, but we ended up talking about everything. City streets, equity, human rights. So it is a sort of overarching concept showing how important water is to everything we do in our lives. And that was absolutely striking to me, that we could go from engineering, you know, how do you process water before you send it back to the lake, down to human rights and the people who live here and there in the neighborhoods and that did not have access to water and that should have had access to water like anybody else. So it's great to see that all these aspects are considered and how water is so important.
Is it an overstatement to say that community engagement is equal in importance to the future of the Great Lakes as the latest science, technology, and of course dollars?
More important, because suppose you have science and you have the knowledge, but you don't tell anyone, it's useless. Any knowledge that is not shared is useless, and you have to share it in a way that is meaningful to the people. And from the other end, you have to have community that buys into all this. The community to tell scientists and legislators, this is what we want. Community involvement, I think, is the most important aspect of the whole exercise.
I always bring it back to the consumer. You know, we are how we live. The products we choose to buy, how much plastic do we want to use in our lives? What kinds of standards do we want in the products that we purchase, or the way we manage our lawns, you know, the way farmers farm? All these decisions are made based on consumers and what the consumers are wanting. And a lot of the chemicals of concern in the Great Lakes come from products that used to be used years ago that had contaminants in it. And I think when the consumers understand what these contaminants do and find viable alternatives to using those, well, then that prevents the contaminant from getting in the water because we're not using it. So that's where I think it's really important for people to understand that how they live directly affects the water quality, and the water quality will in turn impact the way they live. So it's a mutual relationship, and it's important for everybody to understand that when you choose to use a reusable bottle instead of a plastic bottle, that's a decision that will impact how your tax dollars are used for cleanup. You know, it will affect, you know, the ecosystem. And when people start to understand, well, I can use a reusable bottle instead of a plastic bottle, and I still get my water and my drink, and I won't affect the environment that way, well, that's a step in the right direction for all of us.
What do you consider to be the most pressing issue facing the Great Lakes?
Wow, that's a big question. You know, you name something like Asian carp. That's fundamental. This animal is a monster. You know, we have to keep it out of the lakes and keep it out of the St. Lawrence and all the rivers. It's fundamental, but on the other hand, there are other things that matter. For example, rehabilitating rivers so that people can see how beautiful, how peaceful, how clean it is, and they can kayak or walk or fish. This is extremely important as well. So I can't grade them, but it's like, you know, there are many problems on this planet, climate change and famine in some countries. They're all important, but I think every person should select or choose what their cause will be. And if everyone had a cause, we would solve a lot of problems.
As Pierre pointed out, the lakes are so vast. They're so big. They cross so many jurisdictional boundaries. The good news is that we have a plan. The two countries are working together. There's been a lot of effort put into coordinating efforts on all of these different issues. So Asian carp, invasive species, emerging contaminants, all of these issues are recognized, and there's a plan. And some aspects of the plan are being implemented more effectively than others, and that's why we're here to assess, well, how well are they doing? We're going to make sure that we focus and there's attention paid to the aspects of the plan that are not quite fully implemented.
Do you feel as though you've come back aboard and on board at a particularly critical time in the Great Lakes and in the world?
Critical point, maybe in the context of climate change. I think we are facing maybe one of the major challenges that we have faced as humanity. The climate will be changing, and the question is, what does it mean in terms of a given area? Being the IJC, we also have orders of approval on rivers, you know, between Dakota and Manitoba and between Montana and Alberta. Some parts of the country will be drier and some will be more humid. And this will be our major challenge for over the next 20, 25 years. We are very likely to see major changes.
I think this is a pivotal time to be here with the IJC to start understanding the impacts of these variable weather patterns on our orders and see if there are changes that need to be made based on what the new weather patterns are and whether or not these weather patterns are going to continue or if this is just an anomaly that'll be over in a year or two. We really don't know yet, but this is all things that we're working on right now.
Resilience is going to be a major term. You know, I commend what Senator Schumer announced for New York State, you know, a commission or a group of people looking at how to become more resilient. I commend the government of Quebec who announced that they will no longer allow rebuilding houses on a floodplain. And if you look at the map of Quebec, they have put in red all the areas where they will no longer allow rebuilding. And that's a lot of surface. So what does that mean for the people who are there now? How are we going to make the transition from where they lived to where they will be living in the future? And this will be a major undertaking for governments all around North America. And it's not only small villages or people living on beaches. It's New York City, major cities. In Canada, it will be the same too for cities that are near the ocean. If the ocean over the next 50 or 60 years rises half a meter, what will we do? So resilience and planning for that is of the utmost importance.
Jane Corwin and Pierre Bellon are the U.S. and Canadian chairs of the International Joint Commission. Lake Effect Susan Bent spoke with them during their recent visit to Milwaukee. The IJC's tour of Great Lakes communities continues. Later this month, they'll visit Traverse City, Michigan. The commissioners say they're eager to hear everyone's perspectives and concerns for the Great Lakes. You'll find a link for online comments at WUWM.com. Coming up next, although the HPV vaccination has been available for more than a decade, vaccination rates remain low. We'll talk with a former OBGYN who's working to change that when Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The human papillomavirus is considered the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. Many people know that the disease can cause cervical cancer, but it's also known to cause other kinds of cancer that affect both women and men. Although a vaccine has been available for more than a decade, vaccination rates remain relatively low, especially among boys and men. According to a CDC survey, around half of teens were up to date with the vaccination as of 2017. Dr. Brian Baer wants to change that. The retired OBGYN has given public presentations about the effects of HPV and the benefits of the vaccine. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about what HPV does and why vaccination rates remain low.
One of the reasons that I'm here today is secondary to the fact that regardless of the educational efforts that are going on to have people immunized for the HPV virus, the numbers are staggering how low they are.
Yeah, what makes you passionate about HPV? Because I think a lot of people who are older in particular don't think of HPV as being as pernicious an STI as some others like chlamydia or gonorrhea.
Well, HPV vaccine has been available since 2007. And what makes me passionate about it is the elucidation of its impact on our health and society and its ability to cause cancers, not just genital cancers, but anal cancers and penile cancers and oropharyngeal cancers. All of those things are HPV related. And we now have a tool that can impact society dramatically, yet the numbers are amazingly low. To this day, when I lecture people about HPV and diseases of the cervix, I'll ask independently in the room, I'll ask the women to raise their hands who have had the vaccine. Typically, it's about a 90% success rate with women. Then, uniformly, the men are 20% or less have received the vaccine. And there's a history of why people aren't getting vaccinated. And I think it needs to be discussed along with what's available now and what the current recommendations are.
I'd like to take a step back and kind of go over what HPV is, because you hear this, you know, acronym, and I think a lot of people think of one thing, but HPV is actually kind of an overarching term for a number of different infections.
Well, well said. HPV is a virus. It's a DNA virus, and it's spread via mucous membranes mainly, but also by contact. And there are over 200 different types of the HPV virus. 14 of those types, also known as subtypes, are the ones that are considered high risk and cause diseases of the cervix, which is really where the HPV virus really began to be elucidated, was its impact on the cervix and its ability to cause precancerous and cancerous lesions. It always gives me pause when I think about back in the 80s when we would talk to people about their abnormal pap smears and lesions on their cervix. They would come in and we would say, you have HPV. We used to think that it was the herpes virus that caused all these problems. And they would then say, well, I've got this in my vagina and on my cervix, and you're now telling me it's part of the lower genital tract, the mucous membranes. Can my significant other get this by having oral sex? And we would say, well, there's no studies or data that really tell us that. Boy, were we wrong. And HPV is now the fastest rising cause of oral cancers in men. And so we are well aware of the high-risk nature of these 14 subtypes, and it's fascinating the way the vaccine has been introduced and the improvements that they've made through the years on how it's distributed and to whom.
Yeah. So what is the vaccination rate in the United States?
Well, some of the latest data shows that 60% of women initiate the vaccine series and only 40% of boys or men. And I think that has a lot to do with how the recommendations have evolved to include men in the series. But the more contrasting and stark piece of information is that only 40% of women finish the series and only 20% of men finish the series. So there's a low amount that are initiating it and an even lower amount that are completing it. And this has a dramatic epidemiologic impact on society to produce herd effect reductions in the impact of not only precancerous abnormalities of the cervix, but cancers across all these different areas, the pharynx, the larynx, the hypopharynx, the anus, the penis, all these areas, we can reduce cancer.
You know, when we're talking about HPV, It's one of the most common STIs.
It is.
In the United States. How many people have HPV already, and how likely are you to contract it?
Well, some of the data shows that over 17,000 women will have contracted it or will contract it, and over 9,000 men. There's well over 9 million people that have contracted HPV when you look at overall. That's a yearly rate. And we're seeing reductions. And I think because the vaccine is now being onboarded, not to the impact that I would like seeing, but it eventually will produce herd effect and reduce the number of new infections on a yearly basis. And so the numbers are real, and they're large.
Well, and if you're one of the 9 million people who contracts it in a year, does it make sense for you to get a vaccine, or are you already too far gone? Will it do anything for you?
It makes 100% it makes sense, because if you think about it, if you backtrack again, we used to tell people that over 80% of people are exposed to HPV virus by the time they're 21. And when we first started dealing with these issues, we would do pap smears on women as soon as they became sexually active. And we would treat any abnormality. And we learned that this is overkill, that the natural history of the virus is that our body's immune system will eventually suppress it, provided that it doesn't produce a precancerous lesion that goes on to cancer. Now, some of these subtypes are very aggressive. Type 16 and 18 are the most aggressive subtype. They produce 70 to 80% of precancerous and cancerous lesions. What we've now found is that there's a number of other subtypes that can impact it. So that said, if you've had the original vaccine, which only covered for four of the subtypes, now there's an even newer vaccine that covers for five more. So if you've been exposed to one subtype, it's still worth getting vaccinated to protect you from these other high-risk subtypes. And along those lines, if you'd like, I can talk about the fact that the original vaccine was brought out in 2007, and it was for women ages 11 to 25. And there was reluctance to immunize people in pediatric offices and family practice offices because at that age, they go through so many vaccines that it was just another thing to talk about. And a lot of people felt that as long as you're not sexually active, we can wait until later to give this vaccine. But the best impact is to do it all together and teach people that it's a vaccine that prevents cancer. It's not to prevent an STI. It's more for cancer reduction. So the original vaccine was four subtypes. It was type 6 and 11, which are a slow-growing part of the virus that actually causes more of the genital warts that you would see on the vulva and on the penis. It also included type 16 and 18, which were the high-risk, fast-growing subtypes, and that helped prevent 70 to 80% of those things that cause it. The one problem that's out there is that it didn't include men or boys. And so suddenly, a couple of years later, they decided that we need to include boys into this series. And it just took off so slowly that the impact is today felt very strongly that there's not a real push. Recently in 2014, they added a new vaccine called 9-valent Gardasil, which includes five additional subtypes. And that will reduce the risk of cervical cancer by up to 90% now. And many of these cancers, it increases the cancer reduction by up to 15%. So now everyone is getting 9-valent Gardasil. And they've included, it has recently been added as of 2015, that men ages 11 to 25 should get the vaccine. And then what I think is beautiful is recently, last October of 2018, they decided that ages 26 to 45 should get a vaccine, that it will help and make an impact. So, I mean, they've finally decided to cover all components of the populations that could be exposed, because patients used to come in and say, you know, I'm 29 and I've missed this series, and the way you talk about it, I would like to get the series. And I say, well, insurance isn't covering it because it's not part of the guidelines. But if you want to pay for it, I'm sure you could get the vaccine. And now FDA guidelines have been approved for ages 27 through 45.
You know, you mentioned that women tend to get it more than men through sex. Why is that?
I think those are some of the initial numbers about the exposure rate. And I think if you look at those numbers in the next 2 to 5 years, you're going to see a change in those numbers. But I think the answer to your question is that women have more mucous membranes that can take up the virus, namely the vagina, and that can impact the surface of the cervix and the cells on the cervix. So I think that's where you're seeing a lot more of the uptake of the virus itself.
That makes sense. So, you know, when you're talking to people about HPV, the vaccine, where does the reluctance come from? Why aren't people getting this vaccine as much as they should be?
Well, that is the million-dollar question. I think what we're doing now is we're educating clinicians, practitioners, about how they have to approach patients. I think the initial feeling about the vaccine was the fact that someone's getting a vaccine to prevent an STI, as opposed to overall cancer reduction and herd immunity. So when we talk to people now, we have to approach it differently. The other thing is that men weren't really included in that discussion. And I think that it's still extremely slow to take off vaccinating men. And it's astounding to me. I have made it my mission to try and educate men on getting out there and getting vaccinated because it's a subset of our population that still could be harboring the virus and spreading it. The good news is that more and more women are getting vaccinated. It's becoming more routine in offices. When I had patients come in and tell me that their daughters weren't getting offered the vaccine in their pediatric office, I used to have them bring their daughters into my office at the end of the day for vaccination. And I think I was successful in vaccinating a lot of young ladies that wouldn't eventually have not received the vaccine. So we're learning where our deficiencies have been in education. We're also trying to incorporate the series as along with the meningococcus vaccine and the Tdap vaccine that these kids get at that age. And if we incorporate it and just say it's part of the series and say it's for cancer reduction as opposed to preventing STIs, I think we'll be much more effective in completing the series for more and more people.
Dr. Brian Baer is a retired OBGYN and an adjunct professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also an advocate for the HPV vaccine and has given public presentations about the impact of the virus. Dr. Baer spoke with Joy Powers, and you can find out more information about HPV and about the vaccine at WUWM.com. Coming up next, our Beats Me series examines the effect on African American men when there are few black male doctors available to treat them. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North. Your doctors can play an integral role in your life as they address medical problems and help you become and stay your healthiest. All patients are more likely to connect with physicians who are from the same background, which means better overall care. But this can put African American men at a disadvantage, as there simply aren't as many black male doctors available to treat them. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell investigates in today's installment of our Beats Me series.
You might say the late Dr. Alan L. Heron set the pace for black physicians in Milwaukee, especially black men. He's believed to be the first African-American male doctor to practice here. Heron wasn't a native of Milwaukee, but came here in 1900 and practiced until he died at the age of 93 in 1956. In the decades since, Black men have followed in his footsteps, but the number of African-American physicians isn't as high as one might expect. For this week's Beats Me question, one of our listeners wanted to know why. My investigation began with Dr. Normal Pohl Hunter. She was the project lead when the Association of American Medical Colleges in Washington, D.C. studied the issue 5 years ago. The study looked at things like how many Black men applied to medical schools and how many were enrolled.
In terms of matriculation, those that actually entered, in 1978, there were 542 Black male matriculants to our MD-granting institutions, and the number in 2014 was less. It was only 515.
Dr. Pohl Hunter was concerned by the decline.
For us, this was disturbing because if we think about the history of the United States, you know, civil rights and access to education, we anticipated that there would be increases over time, considering progress that has been made for African-American communities, in particular in the United States. And to see this, it was very concerning.
Now, it should be noted that the numbers have gone up since 2014. Numbers from last year show a 4.4% increase in Black male applicants and a 7.3% increase in Black men enrolled in medical schools. But the number of Black men pursuing careers as physicians remains low compared to other groups. And there are a variety of factors that contribute to the numbers. According to the report by the Association of American Medical Colleges, Black men deal with stereotypes, racism, or prejudice in school from when they are young through their college years. In addition, they have fewer financial resources and a lack of knowledge about what it takes to apply to and get through medical school. And Black boys and young men don't grow up with African-American physicians as role models. Dr. Kevin Izzard is a family physician and the president of the Cream City Medical Society. It's a Milwaukee organization that seeks to eliminate minority health disparities.
I talked to a group of kids earlier in the year, a group of third graders, and one of the third graders told me, well, Black people can't be doctors. And I said, well, look at me. And they just don't, they think about basketball players, they think about football players. They don't see themselves being doctors.
The good news is pipeline programs in medical schools are trying to increase the number of Black men and those from other underrepresented groups who apply to and complete medical school. Dr. Malaika Syker is the Associate Dean for Student Diversity and Inclusion at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She says it has pipeline programs that have been in place for decades.
The first program is called AIM, Apprenticeship in Medicine, and that program is geared towards high school students. The goal is to bring in high school students from backgrounds that are underrepresented in medicine and expose them to experiences in the medical professions. So these students have an opportunity to participate in medical education lectures, hands-on projects, and they also get to do shadowing in clinics with clinicians.
RHODES and DSHREP are the other programs for high school students and undergraduate students, respectively. DeWante Shuford, a second-year student at the medical college who grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, thinks those are some of the best resources.
Oh, man, and that's, oh, my gosh. The pipeline programs, I wanted to mention that. That's man, that's amazing opportunities. I wish I would have had that when I was in high school. Like, I feel like those are the things that we need to bring about the exposure.
Shuford's goal is to become an emergency medical physician. He says while he had a network of support around him and the drive to pursue a career in medicine, not all young people do. And he says it's essential for Black men to become physicians, especially when it comes to preventative care for other Black men. African-American males reportedly have the lowest life expectancy of any major demographic group, and seeing a doctor that looks like them could encourage them to keep coming back. And physicians of color are more likely to treat minority patients and practice in underserved communities. So just something to think about before you make your next appointment. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by The Doman Company.
Taryn Powell is WUWM's Race and Ethnicity Reporter. You can find more of her stories at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break, and then it's all things pets when we chat with Milwaukee Magazine's Lindsay Anderson. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR right after this short break.
Thank you.
are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Pets are an important part of many people's lives. From cats and dogs to reptiles and insects, humans and other creatures often share their lives with each other, to the benefit of both the pet and the human. This month's Milwaukee Magazine has a multi-page spread on pets in our area. It was edited by our next guest, the magazine's culture editor, Lindsay Anderson, and she is with us in the studio now. Hey, Lindsay, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Glad to be here, Bonnie.
Yeah, great to have you here. And, you know, we're talking about something that's kind of near and dear to my heart, and that is pets. And I am the proud servant of a cat.
Aww.
Do you have pets yourself?
Yes. Actually, I was really excited to work on this story. I adopted a dog from Matic about a year ago, and I'm already very obsessed with him. So, yeah.
And Matic is a great place, as is the Wisconsin Humane Society and all the other shelters that are that are doing great work around that. And so let's start with shelters, because that's part of this spread, is talking about animals who are adoptable in various shelters around. Milwaukee seems to have quite a lot.
Right, we do. And we also have a lot of no-kill shelters in particular, which is great. There are a lot of organizations, Happy Endings, for instance, Haws, that do a great job of finding these pets, often transporting them across the country, often from states in the South, bringing them here and then finding them homes. So, yeah.
And both, I know both the Wisconsin Humane Society and MADAC, which is an inter-county agency, they are essentially no-kill as well, unless the animal is so injured that it can't be saved, which I think is wonderful, because it's kind of like everybody's in this idea that it doesn't matter that we have extra animals. We're going to keep them around until they can find homes.
Right. They do everything they can. And I think they really go above and beyond when it comes to even bringing in professional photographers a lot of the time to take photos of the pets and get them up on the website and spreading awareness, too. They definitely are of the mindset that regardless of how old the pet is or what issues it might be working toward, if it can be with people, then it deserves a home, and they'll try to find them one.
When you were doing the research for this spread, did you find that the different shelters and agencies work together pretty well?
Yes. I think a lot of them do. I mean, the Humane Society and MADAC, for instance, I think are constantly in very close communication. And then there are also a lot of interesting organizations like the Urban Cat Coalition, for instance, that works exclusively with feral cats. It will tag them and sterilize them so they don't go back out into the world to make new feral cats, and then release them back where they came from. But they're often in talks with shelters as well. If they pick up a cat that looks like it could be homed, then they will reach out to local no-kill organizations to try to place them there. So yeah, I think it just seems like all of these people are doing it because they care about the pets. They all want to work together to try to find them the best homes.
So we have that part of the spread. Another piece of it that fascinated me was this profile on a dog walker. And, you know, I thought about that, and I thought that's really funny because you see dog walkers all the time, but I hadn't thought about it as an interesting story, and of course it is.
Yeah, absolutely. And this actually came about because the dog walker walked several dogs in our editor-in-chief's building. So she would just see him coming in and out with different dogs multiple times a day and sort of struck up a conversation with him and found his story very interesting. And yeah, he's a really interesting guy. He dabbled for a while in a sort of high-powered career and then just decided that it really wasn't for him, that he wanted to be able to set his own hours and have freedom and also spend time outside. So he found that starting a dog walking business was really the perfect job for him.
And he liked dogs, which is a
absolutely
huge thing.
Yeah,
you've got to want to be around the animals.
Right.
Otherwise, it's just as tedious as
absolutely.
As something else. You also have this really wonderful two-page part of the spread, which is Tales on Trails. We know dogs love to be outside, and they mostly want to be off-leash, but in the city, they have to be on leash. But it's places to go that you might not know that you can take your dog.
Yeah. This spread in particular was really interesting to me because, like I said, I adopted a dog. I'd been taking him to the dog park in Bayview, which I love, but I wasn't aware of even half of these trails, really. And so it was just sort of great hearing from the writer, watching her assemble all of these places and sort of putting together this list of great places to take your dog. And she divided it up into on-leash and off-leash dog parks, and then also places by the lake or on the water, which is great, too.
You can let the dog
swim. Yes, yes.
Yeah. Have you taken your dog to any of these yet?
We're actually planning a trip to Manuka Park this weekend. So we've been waiting. The weather's been terrible, but this summer we definitely have plans to start taking him more places.
And Manuka is one of the places that you can take your dog off leash.
Right, yes. And it's got plenty of acres, 19 acres. And I've heard great things about it, so I'm excited.
You'll
it's
have to report
in the
back.
Woods too. Yeah. Yes, I will do that.
It'd be fun. And part of this, too, is not the kind of thing that a lot of people think of, which is actually walking your cat.
Oh, yes. We had an intern, we learned, who takes her cat out for walks. So we thought that would be a fun opportunity to have her get in touch with a local vet to sort of hear the ins and outs of catwalking. The vet was very pro catwalking, in case you were wondering. She says it can be good for cats, too. You just have to sort of slowly adjust them to it, because unlike dogs, cats don't love new experiences all the time. So you sort of have to slowly get them acclimated to the idea of going for a walk. But if you can do that, then a lot of them really have a lot of fun with it.
I have seen people out in the neighborhood walking cats. There was one in my old neighborhood where she was probably about 10 or 11, which is a pretty good age for a cat, and very fluffy, very beautiful, and she knew she was beautiful. And so she'd be coming along on her leash, and you know, anybody that walked by and who happened to like cats and would say something, she'd just stop and want to be petted. And I thought, you know, that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Because we try to keep our cats indoors for their safety and also for the safety of birds.
Right.
And, you know, to be able to let them touch ground, too, is a nice thing.
And that is something the vet did say, you know, you have to be alert, keep an eye on them to make sure that they aren't crossing paths with any dogs or, birds or anything like that. But, yeah, as long as you can do that, it can be great fun for you and the cat. Have you ever tried taking yours out?
No, although I'm thinking about it, she's a little skittish in new situations, so I'm not quite sure she would like it.
Yeah, and it's not for every cat.
Yeah, there are some very gregarious cats that I think would really love doing it. But you also have to keep the harness on them, too. They're very good at escaping.
Right, that is true. Yeah.
Before we get to the top dog contest, there's another page that fair warning for people who are freaked out about looking at creepy crawly things. This is covered in scorpions and spiders. And this is for folks who like what you might call non-traditional pets.
Yep. There's an interesting pet store in Bayview. It's called Gary's Pet Jungle. It's very easy to spot because there's a giant mural of Gary painted across the front of it. But they sell a lot of spiders, cockroaches, scorpions, all sorts of interesting creepy crawlies. So if you're interested in a pet but you don't want the time commitment of a dog or a cat, and you don't mind the idea of something with scales or six or eight legs, it's a great place to go.
The idea of having a tarantula crawl across you is yeah.
Yeah.
Spiders don't freak me out, but I don't necessarily want them on me.
Yeah, I'm definitely in the same camp. I did actually have a pet rat growing up that I really loved, but I don't know if I could handle
but
a
that's
cockroach
a mammal.
Or, yes, right. It's still furry.
You can still pet it. Yeah, exactly. It's a different kind of thing. Although, you know, it's nothing to say that spiders aren't intelligent and all that. Snakes too. I love snakes.
I
think they're gorgeous animals. But
yeah.
It's a different kind of pet experience.
Right, and I think the people there say it's less about you interacting with the pet, more about putting them in a terrarium that they'll be happy in and watching them thrive from a little bit of a distance.
Letting them do their
thing. Not that you can't pick up a tarantula, but
And I know you can. But
not me.
You and I will agree on that.
Right.
So let's wrap up today with this contest was going on for a little while. I remember seeing it on Facebook and all of that. And this is people were sending in their pet pictures.
Yes. We know how much people in Milwaukee love their dogs. I, for one, love mine. So we thought it would be fun to reach out to our readers and invite them to send in pictures of their dogs and participate in what we were calling Milwaukee's Cutest Dog Contest. So we got several hundred people who submitted photos of their dogs, and we had the unenviable task of winnowing that number down to about 50, and then we bounced those photos back to the public and let them narrow the number down a little further. And then we selected Milwaukee's cutest dog based on that.
And so who is Milwaukee's cutest dog?
Well, yeah, Milwaukee's cutest dog is a 10-pound Yorkie mix named Barley. He's owned by a young woman named Stephanie, who actually works for Haws. We didn't realize at the time that we would be finding someone who is such a dedicated animal lover. We were honestly basing it off of
photos.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, she's a really dedicated dog lover. She works for Haws, and she ended up adopting Barley because he came in and he had a foot injury, and they needed someone to foster him in case his leg had to be amputated. So she volunteered to take care of him, and then sort of got attached to him and decided to adopt him herself.
It's what's known in the shelter business as a foster fail.
Yep, yep, yep. But an adorable fail.
An adorable fail. Yes, yes, and he is very, very cute. He's got kind of flop ears.
Yep,
and
one ear,
one ear up,
up
and all of that. But I have to say, you know, looking at the pictures, every dog is
right,
the cutest dog.
Right, right. No, that was the hardest part of the contest because really they all could have won. They're all adorable.
Yes.
Stephanie's story was great, too. And she wants to keep working with animals, too. She hopes to one day be a zookeeper. So
very
it was
cool.
Great to have her win. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, Lindsay, thank you so much for putting this all together. It's a great little feature in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me here.
Lindsay Anderson is Milwaukee Magazine's culture editor. The spread on pets is in this month's issue. And that wraps up today's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for another edition of the show here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next. Comes back to tell me that the coast is clear. It's a different world I see when it's just my dog and